Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Stack Overflow podcast, a place to talk all things software and technology. I am Ben Popper, Director of Content here at Stack Overflow, joined as I often am by my colleague and collaborator, Ryan Donovan.
Hey, Ben. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. So I've been thinking a lot about what questions you ask, what decision tree you go through, what the right way to sort of look at bringing Gen AI into your organization would be. Everybody's curious about it. Everybody wants to make sure they don't miss the boat or the productivity gains if they do exist. And so we have a great guest today. Our episode is being sponsored by Intel. We have Rich Herevu, who is an AI evangelist. And we're going to try to break things down. We're going to try to sort of see if we can figure out some good categories, talk through people's decision trees, and then talk a lot about what practitioners are actually doing and how they're using some of Intel's tools to do it. So Rio, welcome to Stack Overflow podcast.
Awesome. Thank you. Great to be here, Ben and Ryan.
So let me start out. You know, I gave you a little bit of like my idea of like how you might break it down. You could build your own foundation model. I've heard lots of different numbers thrown around, but you know, 150 million to train a prior version of ChatGPT. I'm sure it'll be more the next time. And even, you know, like a 70 billion parameter Llama 2 model that you want to work on, you're talking, you know, weeks or months of time and a couple million dollars if you want to get it right. So quite a significant investment. On the other hand, instead of building from scratch, you could go grab an open source model. You could just use that as is. Some of them are great, you know, at certain things, or you could fine tune it. We'll discuss later what that is. You can go to a company like Mosaic ML and say, I'd like to buy a model, please. Here's my data. And they'll say, just tell us what you want to start with. You can get a $50,000 version, $100,000, million version. Like, just tell us and we'll scale it up as we go. And then what a lot of people are choosing to do, because it's the simplest and the cheapest to sort of start playing around, is like, I'm just going to build a simple retrieval augmented generation RAG system, and I'm going to point my user queries at an API from OpenAI or Gemini or whoever.
Exactly.
It'll go there, I'll get a response back, and then I can even, you know, use some prompt engineering to filter that response and make sure that the output to the user is good. What do you see people working on in sort of your ecosystem, I guess? Like, you know, what you're doing, and what do you think about that breakdown? What am I missing, or what would you clarify about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you broke it down really well, Ben. There's a lot of choices out there for different types of stakeholders too, right, that are making these decisions. And that's something that I always like to think about when we're framing this. So I'm, you know, a developer by trade, and, you know, I come in with a background from data science and AI engineering. So for me, a lot of what I look at is also not only the AI models, but the surrounding infrastructure around it, right? We're looking at continued maintenance and deployment of a model and its performance at runtime in the so-called real world, right? So I think that, you know, with all of those factors in play, I definitely agree. You know, there's so many different choices out there. And, you know, RAG, in terms of just connecting an external knowledge base, is the most accessible for a lot of organizations. And we see that at Intel too, when we're talking to partners and external facing developers, especially as part of my role as an evangelist, they really want to get solutions prototyped and out there and be able to update them without maybe not having, you know, too much AI expertise or being able to focus their expertise on other problems. On the other hand, you're really looking for performance and customization with building these large language models, again, for use case by training or fine tuning and getting that quality out. And then with the other platforms, again, as I mentioned, infrastructure is a really big thing. You know, when you're purchasing an off-the-shelf model or even a customized model for your use case and working with a team to co-create something like that, you're also looking for the platform, the tools, and maybe even the monitoring technology and plugins that you can incorporate. So a lot of interesting things to think about. And definitely we see a wide variety of feedback, responses, and interests from different members of the AI community and other organizations.
So Ben mentioned the building your own model. If somebody wants to go the full DIY route, you know, obviously we've heard the numbers of like 150 million for a training session. But I've also seen ones where the comp time ran between, you know, 70K and, you know, 150K. For like a 7 billion parameter model. What are the sort of considerations, like if you actually want to go that DIY route, what do you need besides just the, you know, the A100s or the comp time?
Absolutely. So I think that with the DIY route, which is pretty much training your own model from scratch, and I think, Ryan, you referenced a lot of great, you know, statistics. I mean, it depends on like the model again, right? You know, 70 billion parameters, or we're talking 13 billion, 7 billion, and then also the cost of acquiring CPUs and GPUs. An initial appearance is very challenging, right? Because what you're trying to do is acquire the right data, collect it, clean it, and then you're going ahead and picking a model, you know, essentially blueprint or a template of what you'd like to do, and then you're going ahead and creating it. Now, a lot of people, when they say DIY, what they're actually meaning is somewhat being able to leverage an existing model architecture or template, right? We're not talking transfer learning right. or fine tuning specifically. So when we think about that, there's also design decisions there as well in terms of which architecture, which hyperparameters do I select, et cetera. So it's a lot of effort to do that. Now, something that we're seeing to break down a barrier in this space is this emergence of so-called SLMs, right? It's a play on the LLM term. I'm sure both of you have heard of it. It's getting increasingly popular around like small language models or even small generative AI. And that's really the idea of what if you can train a model from scratch to be smaller in footprint while maintaining the same type of performance, right? And that is really becoming an appealing option for being able to do it yourself. But again, you know, cost, compute, and the effort that it takes in terms of time, cleaning, hyperparameter tuning, those are all really big considerations that you get for the quality, right, of a custom trained model.
Yeah, Ryan did a piece recently that referenced some of the research Microsoft did on the Phi series. And if you use a really highly curated data set, you know, you can, for example, get excellent, you know, they were looking at code gen quality or, you know, performance on like coding tests or coding ability to produce code with something that, yeah, is a fraction of the size of some of the larger models. And that's because it's kind of the child of the parent model. Like you said, it's learned, you know, from what the parent has taught it. And yeah, there are ways right now, like the architecture, I believe, for Llama 2 is open, right? You could say like, I'm going to use this architecture, but I'm going to bring my whole own data set to this. And so I've saved a lot of time because figuring out all the hyperparameters, you know, is a big part of maybe some of that upfront cost.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, that expertise also gets into the fine tuning and transfer learning domain, right, Ben and Ryan? I think it's just like a very interesting boundary these days around how much we reuse the architecture. I think for Llama, we saw it. We definitely saw it for Mistral as well. And I think it's really exciting. Some of our colleagues, for example, at Intel, you know, we were looking at our Intel Neural Chat model that was topping the leaderboard for about a week when it comes to Hugging Face's open source leaderboards. And as part of that effort, these are kind of these newer derivatives, right, of these models and architectures. And we see other companies and, again, organizations even in different industries that are creating specialized models for these tasks, mm-hmm. like for different languages. So I think that the ability to reuse knowledge is interestingly a common theme across all of these. But, you know, fine-tuning and transfer learning maybe being that more accessible step compared to custom training of the model where you're literally just, again, with different mechanisms, right, freezing the weights or using decomposition matrices, right, in the case of LoRa. And then you're just reusing, right, actual parts of the model itself and training it on the newer data. So,
yeah. Another thing I wanted to ask you about was that other piece, which is like, you know, in breaking it down, I kind of talk vaguely about like, and there will be, you know, ongoing maintenance and, you know, sustainability challenges. But like, I don't really know what those are. And I'm sure that they're quite significant. I was trying to do some back of the math and it was like, what would the AWS cost be to host? I forget what it was. It was some 7 billion parameter model. It's like, oh, it'd be about 23,000 a month.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you know, if I don't have that many users, I should just be hitting the API at, you know, 1 or 3 cents per token. Mm-hmm. If my app goes viral and I have a million users, suddenly $23,000 a month sounds pretty good if I can, you know, get my own inference cost down. So when you think about, yeah, like hosting your own, whether that's built from scratch, built on the back of open source or bought off the shelf from Mosaic, what are the ongoing challenges for like maintenance and other things? What do you have to think about?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great starter point already because again, it's all about, you know, users. And right now, you know, all in this world of generative AI and LLMs, we're talking about querying and we're talking about endpoints and APIs, right? So whether it's, you know, leveraging APIs already to create some sort of interface like, you know, a travel agent chatbot, which I know is a very popular use case these days, or even, you know, being able to create either if it's a custom model or something similar, and then being able to have APIs that connect to it, cost is a really big factor. Some of the other factors, because you brought up AWS instances, are definitely around the other processes, I'd say, and that we don't really think about a lot when we talk about these technologies, but we quickly encounter them during practical implementation, right? So some of that includes, you know, validation. How exactly are you validating your model? What data are you actually pulling from the model? And again, you know, as I mentioned, monitoring and other types of processes. There's actually this really interesting new concept. I was just reading about it on LinkedIn from one of the newer blog posts in the field called model routing, where you're actually routing requests or queries to different models, depending on how well you know they're going to perform, right? It's really fascinating to me, but that makes me think, how many models are you going to be hosting on different endpoints, right, for that kind of accuracy? Especially because as soon as we start to customize these models in any way, when we're training them on specific data sets, we're you know, trying to prevent catastrophic forgetting and other types of problems with LLMs and, you know, forgetting in general, you know, how specific are we getting and how are we balancing that across multiple models? So I think, you know, that's really interesting to me, whether it's as simple as, you know, I don't know, Microsoft Copilot letting you switch between, you know, GPT-4 and another kind of model, right? Or actually having these own hosted endpoints. So some interesting food for thought.
Yeah, that is interesting. And I wonder if, you know, that's the eventual, everybody's just going to have a bunch of different models sort of working in tandem. And I've heard of it definitely for the evaluation side of things. At one point, does someone have to actually consider, oh, maybe I need more than one model. Maybe one model is not going to hack it.
And I think, you know, the performance benefits also, it depends. And that's actually something that we've been looking into, going into a little bit of a tangent, you know, with a paradigm called hybrid AI. And it's something I got the opportunity to just experiment with, which is, you know, what happens if we, you know, start to think about models that are kind of, you know, in tandem, but also potentially in sequence. And I know there's a couple of buzzwords like chaining AI models or composite AI, but it's really essentially, you know, in order to achieve any use case today, I don't know, like a voice assistant, like Alexa or Siri, you've got multiple models that are working in sequence. You've got voice transcription, you've got text generation, you've got, you know, I don't know, cross-checking, right, for, you know, fact generation, or maybe, you know, content moderation, and then also, you know, text-to-speech, speech-to-text. So I think, you know, a lot of those elements are models running quickly and efficiently and running one after the other with inputs dependent on outputs. So, you know, as part of that, I think one of the paradigms, the definitions that at Intel we've been investigating, again, you know, in collaboration with partners and other teams, is this idea of hybrid AI, where you're thinking about using the cloud intelligently and also being able to use the edge intelligently so that you're balancing between the two. And a really good example of this is maybe you have your audio transcription model on the edge, of course, because that's where it makes sense. You know, you're just quickly being able to note down what someone is saying. But then if you're using something heavy, like an image generator, or maybe, you know, a very 70 billion, very large language model for text generation or checking for a use case, you may be offloading that to the cloud. So I think being able to effectively leverage compute to be able to handle these new paradigms, whether it's models in tandem, smaller versus larger models, or, you know, maybe even models split across different devices, that's really interesting.
Right. Yeah, that's sort of computing at the edge, I think, is something we've talked to a lot of folks about, where it's, you have this tiny device, not much space, but where do people actually put the heavy lifting? Like, do you all think about where that heavy lifting goes and how to make it faster?
Yeah, I mean, that's really what we're focused on doing. And I think we think about it from the perspective of like a company or an organization, but just speaking personally as a developer, it's something that we think about all the time, right? Because, you know, when I speak about these technologies to developers, one of the questions that I get all the time and my team gets all the time is, what are the workloads or the use cases? And personally, that makes me reflect on, you know, what exactly are the pain points or the use cases as a daily user of things like, you know, image conferencing, or, you know, transcribing university notes, or, like, you know, any of those types of apps. What exactly would be my workflow or creating music on the fly? And I think we start to identify those pain points of, I want to be able to take my tablet into a room full of artists and be able to collaborate. And then I want it to be able to upload that so that they can access it at any time and we can edit it. But, you know, I want to be able to do it without internet connection, so I don't have to depend on like cloud subscriptions. So we start to figure out these interesting use cases from a developer-centric perspective, and then also the pain points of compute, right? How do I scale it? How do I make sure I have the right throughput, accuracy, inference, and updating, right, over time, maintenance? So these are definitely all pain points that I'm very excited that we get to think about daily and work on improving.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a great primer on LLMs from that guy, Andre Karpathy, where he says, if I, as an end consumer, were to look at this, I can basically run Llama 2 with these two files, maybe 500 megabytes on a basic MacBook. Mm-hmm. And now I can ask it questions and get back coherent chat that has all the benefits of all the training that's gone before it. So like to your point, you know, image generation or video generation, which is coming, probably more compute intensive audio. But it is kind of striking in some ways how small these things are. And I know Ryan and I love to joke about, can you get Doom, you know, running on a toothbrush or whatever. I do see people competing now kind of in the Hugging Face leaderboard kind of way of like, you know, what kind of device, a Pixel, a smartwatch, you know, et cetera, can I get this model to run on?
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, you know, Ben, you raise a really great point. And I think that, you know, it's really an interesting contention, but also I think it's a really good opportunity because we see on one hand, and I've seen the research, right, from Microsoft and I mean, you know, other companies in the space, Meta and others, like around getting large language models on, you know, smaller devices, right? Like very large language models on smaller devices. And, you know, at a certain point, there are some benefits and advantages to that approach compared to getting smaller, optimized, quantized, compressed, right? Large language models and generative AI models onto a device as well. So I think it's that interesting balance of, you know, what are we sacrificing in terms of the trade-off and how we can narrow that trade-off so we're getting benefits out of both ends. I think that's a really interesting way of approaching it.
Yeah. And I think that's the, interesting. You talked earlier about the small language models. I'm wondering, like, first, you know, how small can you get it and still have it be a coherent language model, like seeing the Tiny Stories one, which is in the millions of parameters. And then is there a point where it's better to go a small model or it's better to quantize down?
Yeah, I agree. And I'm not sure. I mean, have you seen the recent one bit model paper?
I think Ben just shared that today.
Oh yeah, I was just reading that today as well. So it's phenomenal. I think we're seeing right benchmarks comparing 1-bit with FP16, and that is just amazing to me, mind blowing. But to answer the question, there is no specific answer to the question today. But you know, the trade-offs right now are definitely between basically trying to get to, you know, a compressed version of the model when we're looking at compression in a way that's using pruning intelligently, because we know that we want to essentially leverage existing architectures. And again, you know, this is an interesting theory of we don't see a lot of approaches yet towards custom building smaller models. We're actually seeing a lot more, I don't know if it's ease, convenience when it comes to being able to take a larger model and then compress it. Again, I think it's because of the performance benefits that we get from, you know, the already trained, ready to go, maybe even fine-tuned, right, architecture. So I think a lot of approaches today are really focusing on that compression and quantization approach. And again, you know, my team, as part of our development on like the open source toolkit efforts and looking at like GGML and other types of compiler and optimization and quantization related libraries and techniques, you know, that's really the approach that we've been taking, which is, you know, how can you take these models, compress them, right, by having their precision, reducing their memory footprint, reducing their size. And then we start to evaluate how has it changed over time. And that's a question for us too. It's super interesting to think about how some properties of the models can be the same, maybe like faster runtime even and equivalent accuracy, but maybe some properties do change over time. That along with the evolution of small custom built models is definitely going to change the landscape.
Right. Yeah, I love the idea of being able to route, you know, different requests. So, you know, if I need a children's story, I can go to the 100 million parameter model. And if I, you know, want a interactive video game, it's going to have to be sent to the cloud and the bandwidth is going to have to be pretty good on both sides.
Exactly.
So I guess, you know, you mentioned that this is something you think a lot about. Is this something that you actively play with at home? Like, are you able to do this with just, you know, the sort of hardware setup you have around? And if so, what kind of stuff have you been toying with?
Yeah, you know, I like to experiment with different things. Again, you know, as personally, for me, it's all about ease of use, just because time is limited. You want to try out the latest technologies, you want to get your hands on it. And of course, you want to break it. I mean, you know, in a fun testing way. But
yes.
So, you know, I've tried a lot of different cloud environments. I personally really prefer doing local development as well, just because, you know, there's newer compute, newer technology that's starting to come into play. And again, you know, with some of our initiatives, we've been working on the AI PC, which is basically, you know, something where you're able to have three different types of compute, CPU, integrated GPU, and then NPU. And then you basically get to split your workload across the three. So again, you know, personally as a developer stepping outside of Intel, to me, that is really interesting because I'm able to use an AI accelerator for the workload that I wanted to, but I don't have to overload it. I can basically say, I want the performance that the GPU offers for my image generator, but I really don't need it for my audio transcriber. So you can use my CPU resources. And for me, that kind of control helps with identifying the workloads that we need. So personally, again, you know, I'm fascinated with the edge. I've been working in, you know, edge and IoT environments for the last 5 years. So I really like to see the compressed way that we can actually implement things. But I also think the cloud is also offering lots of opportunity, again, for collaboration, for bringing in domain experts to be able to like review models and collaborate in real time. But yeah, I'd say that's my setup. I mean, I'm getting my hands on an AI PC and trying it out. But you know, a lot of these gaming PCs and laptops as well, when you're getting a lot of performance with integrated or even discrete GPUs, I think that it's really cool to be able to figure out and pick what you want to run your workload on and when. Mm-hmm.
I think that's interesting too. And I wonder how much research and development you all are doing in optimizing that shifting and directing workloads.
That's a great question. Definitely, you know, it's a very interesting paradigm of what we can do, right? So in particular, again, speaking from, you know, OpenVINO, because we collaborate with a lot of industry experts, a lot of engineers and developers come to us with their contributions and their thoughts and their feedback. One of the things that has come out of that is this plugin that can essentially determine which compute is essentially optimal for a particular workload. The reason why I mentioned this is a lot of folks that I talk to think it's pretty much magical in a sense, because, you know, if you're not really sure which compute to map to, which a lot of AI software engineers may not have the expertise on, you know, which hardware accelerator to select or which part of the compute, it is really taking care of that behind the scenes. Now, I think with the AI PC initiatives and especially this hybrid AI stuff where you've got, you know, multiple models in sequence or running in parallel or routing as well, that's actually like in the air. I think that there's a lot of different ways that we are thinking about approaching it, which is, you know, the automatic configuration. But right now, most of it is manual. And I think that's where we're looking to get more feedback from the community around, you know, how can we intelligently do that in a way that fits your use case generically for like all of the people that we're collaborating with and the developers out there, but also that can be customized for use case. So you have control over it, right? So I think it's a fascinating problem.
Yeah. And so it sounds like there's a great opportunity to do this at home. For folks who are listening, is there a playground you would recommend? I know when we were talking with your colleague Raymond earlier, he was mentioning some resources where folks go to learn about this kind of stuff. But does Intel provide, you know, like a sandbox of sorts where people can go and try this stuff out?
Yeah, I mean, we've got the OpenVINO notebooks repo. And what I love to say is that, you know, every time there's a newer state-of-the-art workload out there, almost every workload, our engineering team works very hard to be able to actually incorporate it and support it. So for me, the reason why I like it is you get basically the step-by-step tutorial breaking down what exactly is going on within the model. And you're also seeing the compression taking place within the tutorial. So again, it's for me how I learned a lot about like stable diffusion or latent consistency models or Llama, where you're actually seeing the innermost models. And, you know, not many people who are leveraging stable diffusion, I mean, most of them do, but not many people who are using it at first glance know that there's, for example, three models within stable diffusion itself. It's kind of like a model pipeline. So I think that breaking that down and understanding how each of them have their own compute requirements, like the unit part of stable diffusion is way more computationally expensive. And it has a lot of issues when it comes to being able to optimize it appropriately, right? These are some unique concerns that I think some of us may not be exposed to just because, you know, the compute intensive nature of it is kind of masked away by some abstractions with popular libraries. So for me, I think OpenVINO Notebooks has, again, you know, become that place, not only me being a part of that effort, but also a place to be able to keep up to date, play around with the technology, also newly being able to take advantage of this, you know, automatic compute identification of the optimal compute and running capabilities and with AI PC too. So.
Cool. All right, everybody. It is that time of the show. I want to shout out somebody who came on Stack Overflow, shared a little knowledge, and was awarded a badge. Thank you, Kevin, awarded a Lifeboat badge 4 hours ago for supplying a great answer. A type error. I must use keyword argument or key function in Python 3x. I'm new to Python. I'm trying to port a script, and I'm encountering this error. Kevin has the answer for you, and we've helped over 25,000 people. So appreciate it, Kevin, and congrats on the Lifeboat badge. As always, I am Ben Popper. I'm the director of content here at Stack Overflow. You can find me on X at Ben Popper. If you have questions or suggestions for the show, you want to come on and chat about something, hit us up, podcast at Stack Overflow. If you like the show, leave us a rating and a review. And by the time this episode comes out, the news will be old, but make sure to check out our blog for news about Stack Overflow being integrated into Gemini AI and Google's Duet Code. That's big news for us as a company. We're excited about it.
I'm Ryan Donovan. I edit the blog here at Stack Overflow. You can find it at stackoverflow.blog. And if you want to reach out to me, you can find me on X at @RThorDonovan.
I'm Rhea Cheruvu, AI software architect and evangelist at Intel Corporation, based out of Arizona in the US. And I currently work on software optimizations for AI models and generative AI. You can find me on LinkedIn and GitHub as well. And please feel free to check out the Open Vito Notebooks repo for more on our work on generative AI and software optimizations. Thanks.
Sweet. All right, we'll throw that Open Vito Notebooks link in the show notes for everybody to check out. Thanks for listening, everybody, and we will talk to you soon.